When you think about PTSD, you probably think of it as a memory problem, right? Like it's portrayed constantly in movies and culture as this ghost from the past that just will not leave someone alone.
Right, yeah, exactly.
We have this pervasive idea that trauma is essentially like a psychological haunting. But what if we're looking at it completely upside down? What if PTSD isn't a memory problem at all, but rather a fear extinction failure? Meaning your brain did exactly what it was supposed to do. It learned how to fear a life-threatening situation, which is obviously a vital survival
Oh,
skill.
absolutely.
But then it physically lost the biological ability to unlearn that fear once the danger actually passed.
It is a profound shift in perspective. You move away from viewing severe trauma as purely, a state of psychological distress, and you start looking at it as a structural blockade in the brain. Basically, the physical hardware is jammed.
And diving into that jammed hardware is exactly what we are doing today. We're pulling from this really fascinating May 2026 article in the OOTW Journal, alongside a pretty deep stack of peer-reviewed clinical data, to look at a compound society has long sidelined as just, a hallucinogen.
Right, psilocybin.
Yeah, we are looking at how psilocybin might actually act as a structural reset button for the traumatized brain. And I mean, the stakes on this are immense. Right now, there are roughly 8 million Americans suffering from PTSD.
It's a staggering number.
It really is. And the response rate to our current first-line treatments, it is basically a coin toss. It's right around 50%. So half the people who somehow summon the courage to seek help simply do not get better with the tools we currently have. So understanding this emerging neuroscience is not just, a theoretical exercise. It is a matter of absolute urgency. Okay, let's unpack this. To really understand how psilocybin is working, we have to drop down to the microscopic level and completely reframe our mental model of PTSD.
Yeah, we really have to look at the brain's actual processing mechanics.
Right. So I was reading through the clinical data, and the best way I can visualize a brain with PTSD is to think of it like a corrupted computer file. Imagine your brain is a camera recording a terrifying video.
Okay.
Normally, after the terrifying event is over, you hit the save button, the video goes into the archive, and it is safely in the past. But in PTSD, that save button is completely grayed out.
The system is corrupted.
Exactly. The video just keeps playing in this endless live loop on your desktop, and you literally can't close the window. In this scenario, the amygdala, which is the brain's threat detection center, is the window playing the terrifying video. It is just redlining. And the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which is supposed to step in and hit that save button to inhibit the fear, is, well, it's severely underactive.
Yeah, and the specific hardware failing to categorize that file is the hippocampus. What the neuroimaging shows us is that in a severe PTSD brain, the hippocampus actually loses physical volume. It shrinks.
Wow, literally shrinks.
Literally shrinks. And its primary job is contextual regulation. Think of it as the timestamp and the GPS tag on a memory.
So it tells you where and when you are in relation to whatever that memory is.
Precisely. A healthy hippocampus tells your brain, yes, that was a massive explosion, but you are safely walking down a suburban street on the 4th of July right now. You are not in a combat zone. It provides the context that you are safe in the present moment. But when the hippocampus loses volume and function, it cannot separate those contexts.
So the memories just sort of bleed in.
They literally bleed into the present-day experience.
Yeah.
The brain structurally cannot differentiate a loud noise today from a catastrophic event a decade ago.
Just imagine for a second what it feels like to live in a state of constant physiological threat readiness. Like your body is pumping out cortisol, your heart is racing, your muscles are locked tight, and you are just, I don't know, trying to buy groceries.
That is the HPA axis, the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, just locked in a state of severe dysregulation. The physical body is bracing for a mortal impact that is never coming, which is biologically exhausting.
Right. So if the brain is physically locked in this defensive overdrive, how do you patch the software? How do you restore that save button we talked about? Well, the OOTW Journal piece highlights a staggering statistic about psilocybin. The neuroimaging data shows that psilocybin reduces amygdala hyperreactivity to trauma cues by 40%.
Yeah, it's massive.
You read a number like that and you really have to pause. 40% isn't just like taking the edge off. That is a fundamental system override. How is a single compound taking the foot off the gas pedal so dramatically?
What's fascinating here is the precise pharmacological mechanism at play. Psilocybin acts as an agonist for the 5-HT2A serotonin receptors. That essentially means it binds to them and actively turns them on. Now, the crucial part is the anatomy. where are these specific receptors actually located?
Right.
They are expressed with incredibly high density in the prefrontal cortex in the limbic system.
Right. Which happens to be the exact neighborhood in the brain that PTSD has hijacked. It is like a near perfect anatomical match.
It targets the exact circuitry that is failing. So when psilocybin activates those 5-HT2A receptors, it ramps up the brain's glutamatergic activity.
So it means what exactly?
Glutamate is essentially the chemical construction signal that tells neurons to start building. This triggers a massive release of something called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Think of BDNF as high-octane fertilizer for the brain.
Okay, fertilizer.
Yeah, a major study in Cell Reports tracked this process and demonstrated that this fertilizer promotes rapid physical, structural neuroplasticity. We are talking about the visible growth of new dendritic spines and the forging of entirely new synaptic connections.
Wait, I have to push back on the timeline here for a second. Anyone who has ever been prescribed a traditional SSRI antidepressant knows the drill. The doctor tells you to take it every day, and maybe, if you are lucky, in 4 to 6 weeks, you will begin to notice a subtle shift. Are you saying psilocybin is driving the actual physical growth of new brain connections in a matter of hours?
Yes, and that rapid timeline is exactly what is upending traditional psychiatry. We are observing rapid structural neuroplasticity. Within hours of a single active dose, the prefrontal cortex regains its regulatory authority. Concurrently, imaging studies show the amygdala's hyperreactivity is significantly dampened.
The threat alarm is finally turned down.
Exactly. And going back to your computer file analogy, the BDNF promotes neurogenesis, the birth of new neurons in the hippocampus. This improves what is known in the literature as pattern separation.
Pattern separation meaning the brain finally realizes the firework is just a firework. It can timestamp the trauma and archive it in the past where it belongs.
Yes, precisely.
So the critical takeaway here for you listening is that psilocybin is not erasing traumatic memories. This isn't some science fiction memory wipe where you wake up and forget what happened to you. It simply reopens the biological window of plasticity required for the brain to update and process those memories.
It restores the mechanical capacity for fear extinction. The memory remains, obviously, but the visceral paralyzing fear attached to it is uncoupled. The brain regains the physical flexibility to unlearn the terror.
Okay, flushing the brain with BDNF and growing new dendritic connections is incredible biology, but how does that actually translate to stopping the intrusive thoughts, like the looping nightmare that tortures someone with PTSD? Well, here's where it gets really interesting. The current literature points heavily to a landmark neuroimaging study published in Nature in 2024, focusing entirely on the default mode network, or the DMN.
Yes, the DMN.
I always think of the DMN as the brain's internal monologuer. When you are zoning out on a bus, daydreaming, or, you know, analyzing a conversation you had yesterday, your DMN is running the show. For most of us, it is just annoying, like when your brain randomly reminds you of an embarrassing joke you told at a party 5 years ago.
Right, we've all been there.
But in PTSD, that internal monologuer gets violently stuck on a loop of worst-case scenarios and traumatic flashbacks.
The DMN becomes chronically overactivated and rigid. And what the neuroimaging in that Nature study revealed is that psilocybin causes a profound desynchronization between the default mode network and the anterior hippocampus.
Desynchronization. So it basically unplugs the two networks from each other.
It completely decouples them. In the traumatized brain, the DMN is constantly pulling corrupted threat data from the compromised hippocampus to feed that internal monologue. By physically decoupling these two networks, you interrupt that automatic self-referential rumination.
The loop is broken.
The feedback loop is shattered. And the vital piece of data here is that this decoupling isn't just happening while the drug is in their system. It persists for weeks. It is a sustained network reconfiguration.
And while those networks are unplugged, the brain enters a state of extreme vulnerability and openness. This connects to another major finding regarding something called the social reward learning critical period.
That concept is one of the most elegant discoveries we have right now. A critical period is a specific developmental window characterized by hyperplasticity.
Think back to when you were 6 or 7 years old. Think about how easily a kid that age can learn a second language without an accent or adapt to moving to a completely new city. Their brains are absolute sponges soaking up the rules of the world. That is a critical period.
Yes, exactly.
But biology demands that window firmly closes when we hit adolescence,
right?
Our brains have to solidify so we can function as adults.
They trade that extreme malleability for efficiency. The adult brain becomes rigid by design. But recent research, particularly out of Nature in 2023, demonstrated that psilocybin temporarily forces that exact same critical period to reopen in the adult brain.
Wow.
You were taking a traumatized adult who has rigidly learned that the world is a uniquely dangerous place, and you are temporarily gifting them the childlike neural flexibility to relearn that they are actually safe.
It is temporarily dropping the armor, but that brings up a genuinely intense question about the patient's reality in the room, because we can talk about BDNF and network decoupling all day, but what is the subjective experience of having your mental armor stripped away?
It's intense for sure.
A massive 2025 meta-analysis looked at the phenomenological data, like the actual trip reports, and found that the quality of the subjective experience strongly predicts the clinical outcome. They weigh the state of oceanic boundlessness against the dread of ego dissolution, which is the clinical phrasing for a deeply distressing trip.
Right.
But wait, if PTSD is a disorder built entirely around avoiding terrible memories, wouldn't dissolving your ego and facing that trauma head on just completely re-traumatize you?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to look at the foundational pathology of PTSD. It is, at its core, an avoidance disorder. There is behavioral avoidance of anything that reminds them of the trauma, and severe internal avoidance of the emotions tied to it. The trauma is walled off.
Right, tightly locked away.
What a state of oceanic boundlessness achieves is the temporary suspension of the brain's entire defense architecture. The rigid boundaries of the defended self simply loosen and fall away.
Because the DMN, the ego center, is offline, so they are instinctively fighting the memory the second it surfaces.
Precisely. The avoidance mechanism is disabled. Crucially, the patient does not re-experience the trauma in its original visceral horror. Because the amygdala is chemically dampened and the prefrontal cortex is heavily engaged, the patient enters a state the literature refers to as retrospective witnessing.
Retrospective witnessing. It sounds almost like watching a movie of the event from the back row of a theater, rather than being trapped inside the movie itself.
That is a perfect way to conceptualize it. They can view the trauma from outside their usual panic defenses. The material finally becomes processable because the biological terror alarm isn't deafening them. The event can be observed, categorized, and archived.
And the data emphasizes heavily that this session, this profound six-hour experience of oceanic boundlessness, is just opening the door.
Yeah.
The real lasting work happens in the integration window.
Yes, the integration is key.
Those are the weeks immediately following the session where the brain is still bathing in BDNF, still highly plastic, and the DMN is still decoupled. The OTW Journal actually highlights some fascinating adjuncts being used during this integration phase. Therapists are exploring things like theobromine-rich ceremonial cacao.
Oh, the cacao protocols, yeah.
The high flavonoid content and increased cerebral blood flow from the cacao are being used to actively sustain that neuroplastic substrate for as long as possible. It is all about stretching that window of opportunity so the behavioral therapy can really take root.
The pharmacological session simply creates the window. The psychological integration is what builds the new house. The therapy reorganizes the schema while the cement is still wet.
Okay, so the underlying neuroscience makes sense. The subjective psychological experience maps beautifully onto the biology. But the ultimate question is, does this actually heal people in the real world? Let's look at the clinical reality.
The outcomes are what matter.
Exactly. The strongest signal right now comes from a 2025 phase 2 trial. They took 22 participants and administered a single 25 milligram dose of a synthetic pharmaceutical grade psilocybin called COMP360. They then tracked their trauma severity using the CFP5 scale over 12 weeks.
The CFP5 is the absolute gold standard diagnostic interview for PTSD. It is a rigorous, structured assessment scored from 0 to 80. In clinical terms, a drop of 10 to 15 points on that scale is considered a highly meaningful reduction in suffering.
And in this trial, they saw exactly that. Meaningful, sustained reductions that didn't just spike and fade, but persisted across the entire 12-week follow-up period from a single dose.
It is a remarkable signal. And to truly grasp where psilocybin fits into the future of psychiatry, we have to look at it in comparative context.
Yeah.
We have to bring in the landmark phase 3 trials for MDMA-assisted therapy that concluded a few years prior.
Right, because the MDMA data is almost unbelievable. In those late-stage trials, roughly 67% of participants improved so dramatically that they no longer even met the diagnostic criteria for PTSD.
Incredible.
Two-thirds of the cohort were effectively cured of a supposedly lifelong affliction. So if MDMA is that effective, what is the difference in the room? Why pursue psilocybin at all?
It is a critical distinction in mechanism. MDMA acts as an entactogen. It creates a massive, temporary flood of serotonin, dopamine, and oxytocin. It wraps the patient in an overwhelming sense of safety, profound social connection, and emotional warmth.
So it's very relational.
Exactly. This makes MDMA exceptionally well-suited for complex relational trauma-like childhood abuse, where establishing a therapeutic alliance and a deep feeling of interpersonal safety is the absolute prerequisite to processing the memories.
Whereas psilocybin is a classic psychedelic doing something structurally different.
Exactly. Psilocybin drives neuroplasticity and cognitive perspective. Its 5-HT2A agonism is ideal for deeply entrenched, rigid, treatment-resistant schemas. If a patient is completely stuck in deep experiential avoidance, unable to even look at the trauma because their worldview has become so rigid, psilocybin breaks that rigidity. They do not compete. They are different tools that likely serve entirely different profiles of trauma.
And we desperately need every tool we can get because the human cost of waiting for these therapies is literally unbearable. We have to step back from the neurobiology for a moment and look at the veteran population. We are talking about lifetime PTSD rates north of 30% for Vietnam veterans.
It's tragic.
Post-9/11 veterans are suffering at catastrophic rates. The Department of Veterans Affairs estimates 17 veteran suicides every single day.
It is a profound, cascading crisis. Our standard of care, the SSRIs and traditional exposure therapies, is fundamentally failing a population that sacrificed everything.
You can see the sheer desperation in the sociological data, too. There was a massive study published in iLife tracking over 8,700 people, and it revealed enormous rates of self-medicating microdosers among those suffering from PTSD. People are not waiting for the FDA to figure this out. They are desperate.
No, they can't afford to wait.
We have a completely treatment-starved population taking massive legal and psychological risks, trying to microdose their way out of daily torment because the medical establishment has nothing left to offer them.
This raises an important question, though, and we have to practice absolute epistemic honesty here about where the science actually stands. The data is incredibly promising, but it has serious limitations. That 2025 Phase 2 trial we discussed was an open-label study with only 22 participants.
Open-label, meaning everyone involved knew exactly what drug they were getting. There was no placebo group.
Which means we cannot rule out expectancy effects. If you have suffered for a decade and you know you are finally receiving a powerful, highly publicized psychedelic therapy, your expectation of healing is immense. That expectation alone alters outcomes. Furthermore, blinding a psychedelic trial is notoriously almost comically difficult.
Right, because if you give someone a sugar pill and you give the other guy 25 milligrams of psilocybin, they are going to figure out who got what pretty quickly when the walls start breathing.
Exactly. You cannot easily fool a patient or a therapist about whether an ego-dissolving compound is active. Additionally, standard trial protocols currently exclude the most severe, fragile cases. Patients with active suicidality, severe dissociative disorders, or any family history of psychosis are screened out for safety.
So the people who might need it most.
Right. So the populations with the most desperate unmet need are not actually represented in the current psilocybin data. We are relying on the upcoming massive, randomized Phase 3 trials to confirm what Phase 2 strongly suggests.
So what does this all mean? We are left sitting with this incredible, almost agonizing tension. The biological mechanisms are clear and breathtaking. The way it works on the physical hardware of the brain, the BDNF fertilizer, the reopening of childhood plasticity, the dampening of the fear center is beautifully mapped out.
It really is.
And the early clinical signals are undeniable. But the rigorous, notoriously slow-moving machinery of late-stage clinical trials is fundamentally at odds with the urgent, daily reality of 8 million Americans suffering right now, 17 veterans a day. It leaves you wondering about the very nature of our medical system.
It's a huge paradigm shift.
Our regulatory approval pipelines were designed over decades to evaluate daily pills, things like SSRIs that you take every morning to maintain a subtle accumulating chemical equilibrium. Does that system even possess the framework to properly evaluate a single dose, perception-altering structural brain reset?
It's a friction point we haven't resolved yet.
We started this conversation talking about a brain that lost the ability to hit the save button, a brain that forgot how to unlearn fear. Psilocybin appears to hand that biological ability right back to the patient. But as we wait for the bureaucratic and regulatory bodies to catch up to the frontier of neuroscience, you are forced to ask yourself, how does a modern society properly balance the slow, necessary caution of scientific rigor with the screaming, immediate desperation of human suffering? It is a question without an easy answer, but it's one we can no longer afford to ignore.